Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
All right. Good morning again, and good afternoon or good evening, depending on what part of the world you are in. My name is Audrey, and I will be your host for today's weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. As context of these calls, the purpose of them is really to share stories and to tell stories. And they're stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation along the way. And we do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. So today we're really excited to have our special guest speaker, Doug Powers, who is someone who really embodies today's theme of cultivating and teaching freedom. So thank you again for joining today's call, and let's start with a minute of silence to kind of ground ourselves in this space. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Doug Powers. So here's how the call will work. In a few minutes, our moderator, Preeta, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Doug. And at the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A and circle of sharing, where we'll invite all your reflections and questions. And I've opened up the Q&A queue right now, so at any point, anyone can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. And you can also email us at ask@servicebase.org with any questions that you would like to ask. So this week's theme, as I shared earlier, is cultivating and teaching freedom. And our guest this week has been on a lifelong quest to cultivate freedom and to help others in this quest through teaching. He has come to the belief that true freedom is not the freedom to act on one's desires, but freedom from the mind's habit patterns that bind us to those desires. And so a question for reflection is, what is the freedom you seek? And in what circumstances do you feel like you're in bondage? And since we have the pleasure of our wonderful moderator, Preeta, today, I thought we could start by asking her to kick off our circle. And to give you some context, Preeta is someone who's very hard to introduce because she is just a force of invisible service in many ways with these calls and has been holding space around these calls for a couple of years now. And she's, you know, worked in transforming government and also, you know, worked from places like the Supreme Court to the White House, and now she's really exploring ways to deepen in her own inner journey and cultivate service wherever she's planted. And Preeta, it's a real honor and a gift to have you on the call today. Thank you for joining us. Any thoughts on today's conversation?
Yes, thank you so much, Audrey. I'm so excited to be speaking with Doug this morning. This whole theme of cultivating freedom is something that has been an animating feature of my life as well, but you know, maybe from a little bit of a different direction. I'm a constitutional lawyer and spent a lot of my life thinking about how to foster systems, external systems, that cultivate or allow for spaces of freedom. And it's interesting, when I graduated from law school, when we get our degree, the president of the university says, for all the JD candidates, he says, we are now out to go out into the world to fashion those wise restraints that make men free. And I've thought about that a lot throughout my life, about the wise restraints that make us free. And I spent a lot of time in the external world, you know, working on those restraints, and have come in my own journey to realize that freedom is an inside job. It's not an outside job. It really is about our minds and what's happening within us, and to give ourselves the space and the stillness to change the ways in which we approach the world. So very excited to see, to have this conversation with Doug, who has also been on this lifelong quest of exploring freedom and has, from all that I've read and gathered, has kind of approached it from the other side, from the inside out. So it's a perspective I greatly value. It's one that I'm coming to. So thank you. So excited to be here.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I'll hand it to you to introduce Doug.
Great. So Doug Powers is our guest today, and he's been a teacher at Berkeley High School for nearly 40 years. He started in the late 60s and 70s, and you know, during a time where he described himself as a bit of a happy hippie in the San Francisco Bay Area of the 60s and 70s. He was a student from early on, exploring student of philosophy, early on exploring phenomenology and the freedom of the mind. And it was during that kind of intellectual study of philosophy that he first encountered Buddhism in the form of Master Hua in 1973. And he became very drawn to Buddhist precepts about the mind and the causes and conditions of freedom. And so even while embraced and continuing and teaching Western philosophy, he took upon the study and eventually the practice of Buddhism. He taught, as I said, at Berkeley High for nearly 40 years, and now he's a professor as well as the provost and the vice president of finance and many other roles within the Dharma Realm Buddhist University, which is located about 110 miles north of San Francisco. Doug is incredibly versed, as I said, in both Western philosophy and Buddhist thought, and can speak cogently and compellingly and clearly about so many esoteric topics about philosophy of the mind. But amazingly, in all of his teaching and speaking, he speaks very little about himself. And maybe that has something to do with his view about the nature of the self. Who knows? Maybe we'll find that out. Very little can be found out about him online. As he said to me earlier, he doesn't use email or social media and likes to interact with people only in direct conversation. So, and he's actually proud of his minimal digital presence. So so we're excited to nab him and get him on record and to explore a little bit about his journey in his own life. So welcome, Doug.
Thank you. Thank you. It'll be great hanging out with you guys today.
Great. So actually, just how are you today? Where are you, and how are you feeling?
I'm as usual, just hanging out with myself here, but I'm also in a really beautiful context. I try to hang out both with, you know, in myself, but also in a beautiful context. So I'm here, and I will really enjoy having a conversation with you.
Great. So maybe we can start out a little bit about your personal story. Can you tell us a little bit about how you grew up and some of your early influences before you kind of became a teacher?
Yeah, I don't know how much detail to get into, but going back to, I think maybe starting with the parents, you know, I was really fortunate. I had really great parents who gave me a lot of the basic elements of, you know, who I am. They were super involved in social justice, and my mother worked at the International House, so at dinner, we had people from all over the world all the time at dinner. I didn't know that everyone didn't just hang out with everybody in the world when they were, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. They had, you know, they were the liberal Christians. They were religious, but they weren't doctrinaire or anything, and they really believed that Jesus was about social justice. So I lived in a very with a lot of compassion and also a lot of independence. I think people nowadays would be very surprised by the level of independence a kid had at 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. I rode my bike around Berkeley, went to movies by myself in the fourth grade, fifth grade. I remember listening to Chuck Berry over at somebody's house when the album first came over, and I was just remember that because Chuck Berry just passed away, and I was talking to somebody about, oh, I remember listening to that first Chuck Berry album, hang out with these this girl over in this house and stuff and stuff. And then I remembered I was 10 years old or 11 years old. So I think the level of independence very early on and the support for that from my parents was really important. Also, my mother, very interesting, she had polio in that epidemic and then raised 4 boys in a wheelchair. So her ability to overcome really difficult problems and yet stay very, very positive was really a lesson and probably was another element of my, you know, basic upbringing. And then one of the things about that is that I was able to keep them both in their home in the Oakland Hills by providing support, both myself, my brothers, and other people, the Dharma friends, keeping them in their homes. So I was able to actually keep them. My father died at 97, my mother at 93, and I kept them in the home, in their environment, in a really positive environment through that whole process.
Wow, that's fabulous. And how did you get interested in philosophy and religion? I mean, those seem to have been really early interests of yours. Were there conversations in your family around topics like that, or how did that kind of
like I don't think my parents weren't so philosophical because they were really doers. You know, they did stuff, and they were involved in politics in a direct social justice way. You know, so I don't remember them being particularly philosophical. They were more action and more pragmatic orientated. But there were a lot of values there. I mean, for one thing, we lived in the Oakland Hills in a forest, and we went to the mountain, and there was a lot. There was a really love of nature there that was there early on. I think the philosophy more came from a little bit later on. I mean, I went through you know, the usual kind of rebellion, I guess. You know, if you go back to even thinking about Chuck Berry at 11 years old, there was this kind of rebellion against authority that kind of got going in 57, 58, 59, 60, even before the 60s. There was this sort of James Dean snarl, you know, this kind of Chuck Berry attitude that I was remembering in his passing that you know, a bunch of us, I think, kind of picked up even in the late 50s and early 60s before even the later, you know, later 60s. So I think it's more comes from my personal experience in the rebellion of the 60s that then a lot of questions arose within the context of that rebellion that led to philosophical issues, I think.
Mm-hmm. Can you spell that out a little bit? Like what?
It's a big issue. It's like a 4-hour conversation. But I mean, you know, I mean, I think there was this. It kind of moved from this rebellion to authority, to a kind of. And also, I have to say that we moved from Berkeley to Oakland, and so I actually kind of hung out in the streets of Oakland. I wouldn't quite say I was in gangs, but my good buddies. Fortunately, I had a bunch of buddies that was a real cross-section of people. And later on, my really good buddies became bodyguards of Angela Davis, you know. So I had a really diverse, really early, you know, how to put it, you know, kind of rebellious, kind of danger sort of intensity sort of, you know, sort of thing that then led into the 60s. And as it went into the 60s, that morphed into this rebellion that had to do with, you know, everything, you know, music, lifestyle, drugs, sexuality. There was this kind of complete explosion of freedom of impulse that sort of got let loose. But the problem was that although that, you know, I was, you know, in the music and all that, in my personal experience of it, in actually feeling that through, there was some problems because, although there was this impulsive freedom, it seemed like it constantly got entangled in something, you know, like the freedom went just a certain direction, then it got entangled in something. And so I guess I was really interested in thinking more philosophically and analytical about what was actually going on in the experience of that.
Wow, that's amazing. So how did you get interested in the workings of the mind and phenomenology?
Well, you know, I just read a lot. I think one of the things that people don't realize now, I realize a lot of people don't realize, is part of the 60s, the late 60s, was that everybody I knew read a lot of philosophy and literature and stuff, not as something they were doing in school and class, but just as part of their, you know, their intensity of life was not only drugs and sex and stuff and music, it was also reading, you know, profound texts and being moved by new ideas. You know, and people like at 17, 18, 19 read Nietzsche and Heidegger and Husserl. And, you know, I mean, not everybody, but the people. So it wasn't, you know, it was kind of a natural process to begin to think, to begin to actually have some, you know, reflections that were more philosophical. And that gives you structures, already gives you structures to begin to think about your experience through. Because if you're just experiencing yourself in your senses and your immediate experience and don't have some kind of structure to put it in, then you think your immediate experience is the totality of existence. You don't have another framework. So unless you have the distance, you know, what one good thing that reading does at a certain level, philosophical reading, is it gives you a distance of another mind, another experience to experience yourself through, that then begins to give you that sense of a little distance from just your own experience.
And you talked about that the freedom of the 60s, the various forms that it took, the external forms, would get entangled in something else. And it, and you said you kind of would feel that. So I guess, did you have that kind of consciousness about your senses and the kind of, you know, the reaction of your senses to that kind of entanglement and freedom? Or was this kind of your mind and the philosophy leading you to that?
No, I think because of my upbringing, I remember, you know, having, where the entanglements were a lot were with other people. Like, I think I had a natural respect for other people, like at the level they were having their experience, and somehow just going at it from your impulses didn't allow you to be careful enough about other people. You know, you were like, there's a kind of thing when you're in your own senses and you're only experiencing stuff from your own world, you're not careful about other people. They become projections of your mind, kind of narcissistic projections rather. And I think I was always sensitive enough, you know, to other people that you had to be much more careful about other people and other, in terms of the effect. I think that's really what led me to be wanting to be more careful.
Interesting. And during this time of kind of experimentation in the 60s, did you have any spiritual practices at that time?
My spiritual practices was Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and, you know, yeah, I had spiritual practice. I was never interested, you know, it was always, spiritual practice to me was always the freedom, a kind of sense of freedom and awe and wonder that had to do with nature and music and relationship and so forth. And then how you could develop that to something else, a transformation of wonder. If you live in a world of infinite possibilities where you can do anything, how do you choose what you do? And then how do you turn whatever you choose into not a limitation, but an opening to something else?
Wow, that's really profound. And so in nature and in music, you would, feel this and find your way through choosing these issues?
Well, you just try to take it as intensely as you can. I mean, like, the way I ended up in the monastery was I actually decided to, through kind of a phenomenological analysis of that. So I started using phenomenology to kind of like enter a bunch of different intense experiences, because phenomenology points out the only way you would know something about something is if you enter into the actual experience of that, whether it be another person or another frame of reference or another point of view or and also with nature. So the summer before I ended up in the monastery, I went up to the mountains by myself for a couple of months and lived by myself in the mountains. Wow. And so, like, it's super intense, and one of the things in the process of doing that is that you see where you're, you know, where the limitations of you taking care of yourself are, that being with yourself completely with no reference other than yourself, that there's limited capacity, you know, that you begin to understand a little bit. So a lot of the later interest in why I was kind of interested in Buddhism was as a possibility of a way to be comfortable with myself, because I could see that was really the basis of the freedom, was a deeper level of being comfortable with solitude, being comfortable with what you chose to do in the relations with other people, being having a sense of loyalty and trust that, you know, that at the end of the day in relationships that there was a kind of appreciation of following through on something rather than just kind of an impulsive action or something. This all took a kind of more wisdom than just immediate impulse.
Wow. So what's happened? So you spent the summer up in the mountains, I assume,
in the
Hills or Oakland or?
What was that?
That was in the Berkeley Hills or which mountain?
No, in the Sierra, up in the Sierra. Nevada. I went up to the Sierra Nevada, and I walked through the Sierra Nevada, you know, going up at the very top of the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Was that during college or after college?
No, that was right after college. So I, you know, when I graduated from college, right after graduating from college, I started teaching in Berkeley in 1969. So
that
I chose that because in trying to figure out the best way to use my time and effort, to do something, it seemed like the place where society came together, where all the elements of society comes together, is in a high school, you know, like in a place where everyone, before university, where everybody's already decided, you know, they've already been split off into different groups, and in a place where there was a real big diversity of people, and where, you know, where the dynamic, the social dynamic was really super alive, and so it just seemed like that was the right. And also, you have time with people. In a classroom, you have a semester, a year. There's a possibility for a transformation to occur during all that time. So, you know, for lots of reasons, I sort of chose that as a focus. So, in the summer, right after I graduated with my, you know, master's degree and teaching stuff, I just went up and I just started teaching in '69. I stayed there for off and on at Berkeley High for 40 years. So, one of the things is working with institutions. That's one of the reasons, you know, working with institutions, they go on just doing stuff yourself. I mean, that's just sort of, it's just whatever your thing is, and then you go, and that's okay. But institutions, they do keep going, so the influence through institutions. So I'd already started teaching before I went further with that at that time. So I was already teaching at that time.
Awesome. And so how did you get exposed to Buddhism?
Well, that was actually, again, through phenomenology and the personal experience I had of not feeling, when I got up in the mountains by myself, I realized, wow, I don't have a lot of tools. When you take yourself out of the usual day-to-day life, you realize that your sanity is actually based on your habits. And when you pull yourself out of that entirely, there isn't any, like, ground of your mind that you can use as a marker, as a frame of reference, because it takes away all the frames of reference that you identify yourself through. And then you're kind of lost in a kind of – I realized I needed to find some kind of map or some sort of, you know, sort of roadmap for what the mind, the deeper level of the mind was. And I came across through readings and stuff, some Buddhist stuff, and it seemed like that was a really interesting possibility as a kind of roadmap. So with my usual, you know, my phenomenological approach to stuff, I decided in the summer, the next summer, 73, I decided I would go live in a monastery for six weeks or 8 weeks and not leave the front door and see what happened, you know, see what happened with that. So I had no real interest in it other than as a kind of philosophical, personal thing that would be an interesting thing to see if I could, you know, get something out of in terms of this roadmap.
And how did you find the monastery? How did you choose the monastery?
It was just pure, I mean, we would call in the West, we call it serendipity or luck, of course. Everything's causal, but let's not go there.
So, but it just was complete chance. I mean, my really close girlfriend, woman friend that I was in Berkeley, we just happened to be on the front desk of where she was working at GTU and Graduate Theological Union, and one of the nuns from the monastery brought a little leaflet over and handed it to them to put up. And she knew I was, like, looking around for this Buddhist thing, so she handed it to me, and then that's, you know, I went over there. Then they told me, don't come, because Master Wai won't be here. He's going on a trip. And I said, well, I'm coming anyway. And they said, well, don't come. And I came anyway. And it was completely, like, I was there. It was complete chaos over there when I was there. So, but there was only, like, seven people living in Goldman. At that time, the whole of DRB, the entire phenomenon that's now the city, 10,000 Buddhists and everything, was seven people in the mission on 15th Street.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about Master Wai and why did you choose to go to his monastery?
I didn't choose to go to his place any other reason than I got this little leaflet. I had no idea anything about anything. I had no context of Buddhism or anything. So it was just pure, I don't even know. Obviously, there's some reasons I don't understand even now. But anyway, there was no choice. I just got up and then he wasn't there. So I hung out with these guys over there, the monks and nuns over there. I had no idea what the heck was going on. When I left, I was really happy to get back to hippiedom. Then he called and he came back and somebody called me and said, yeah, you know, you were here, come back. Or I went back over and so he was doing a chan session. So I went back over and did a chan session. And then I actually don't even know. I couldn't even actually tell you. Basically, I guess it was that he was basically saying, I have more freedom than you have. And I said, no, I definitely have more freedom than you had. And we kind of had a freedom war, I guess is what happened.
And this is, I mean, this is a really interesting image that you're painting because this monastery at that time was in a converted mattress factory in the Mission.
Yeah,
district.
In the Mission on 15th Street between Guerrero. It's in a perfect place. I mean, going back now and hanging out with millennials in the Mission, it's, I always walk by it, you know.
And
memory,
so
you know,
no
yeah.
Idea. You had no idea. I mean, when I think of, when people generally think of monasteries, you think of this kind of serene place, you know, where you're striving for inner peace. And so can you describe a little bit about what it's like to, you know, just randomly show up at this monastery, the head abbot's not there, and you're with these newly converted monks and nuns. What is that like? What happened?
Well, they were all Western. It was like it was the Wild West, you know. It was the closest to the Wild West you could possibly get. It was, everyone was just barely starting and being monks and nuns, and they were living in this community. The women and the men, they didn't get along at all, and it was like a constant, like there was these big windows in the back, and they had this big thing. You had to push them up and push them down, and, you know, the women wanted them up, the men wanted them, so they were banging shut and open shut every 5 minutes, and I didn't know anything about Buddhism, and the first thing they were talking, they were reading some part of a sutra on the demon stage of the 50s. I had no idea what was going on, so... it was like, I don't know, I can't even describe, but it was completely fitting to where, what, you know, although it was completely, as far as I could see, I didn't even know what was going on. It was fine because I just, you know, it was in keeping with the 60s and 70s. You know, it was the days that you were walking across University Avenue and you put out your hand to hitchhike. You were going from one person's house to another and you crossed University and you decided to hitchhike and somebody picked you up that was going to Eugene. And you said, fine, and you got right there in your sandals in the truck, went to Eugene and started a new life, and then 4 weeks later remembered, oh, no, I was going to somebody's house. I got to go back. It was no difference in anything. You know, I remember hitchhiking in Europe in 67, and the Hollies picked me up and brought me to London, and you just hang out with the Hollies and the rock people and stuff. It was just, you know, like it was just in keeping with the general chaos at the time. You know, it didn't make, you know.
So after that first chaotic encounter at the monastery or the first session, like what kept you going? What brought you back?
I have no idea. I really don't have any idea.
Well, what was this freedom?
There was something that, you know, Master Wai was the Chan patriarch of Buddhism. You know, his teacher died at 120 and He was bringing Buddhas. He didn't know English real well, though with me. He spoke English most of the time, but that's because I was too stupid to learn Chinese. So he said, well, you're too stupid, so I'll just talk English with you. So, and he lived in the hate. At first, he lived in the hate. You know, nobody knew who he was. He was just like this Chinese guy who came over here to bring Buddhism to the West, didn't really know English very well, didn't put himself up in any kind of way at all, and just kind of hung out until something happened, you know. And he was hiding out. He's a nomad, too. He was like, you know, he was just a nomad, you know. He went from China to Hong Kong, and then he was a nomad into the United States, and he was just an invisible nomad. And so I don't know, you know, running across him, he was like, he manifested a kind of absolute freedom as a nomad, where nothing could hook him. Money couldn't hook him. Sex couldn't. Nothing was interesting to him in that way. And yet, you know, he was like super profound, but nothing, the regular stuff that everybody's interested in was just not, it wasn't even that. It wasn't not interested. It never crossed his mind. You know, I mean, money, sex, all those kinds of too boring to think about. So that was pretty, you know, like, oh my, you know, so there's this whole other like realm of freedom and possibility that isn't even available anywhere here in any kind of way. And how do you get, you know, so it was like a curiosity. How do you get to that kind of nomad freedom? Really, a really good description of this is in A Thousand Plateaus by Deleuze and Guattari. They have this image of somebody on the back of a camel. They say that they have this chapter on nomadism, and it's this somebody's riding on the back of a camel at full speed across the desert, absolutely still going nowhere.
Wow. And so what was he like in terms of his personal qualities? Did he have kind of was he severe? Was he joyful? Was, you know, what was his personal demeanor?
Yeah, he was completely free, you know. So he was, you know, joyful as a mood. I wouldn't say he was limited to be joyful, because that would be kind of a mood. So I mean, he was more free than joyful, but he was like very intense. He was, in his own experience, he was obviously completely free, but in his interaction with other people, he took each person really seriously and wanted each person to actually gain the freedom of their nature and not be so caught up in whatever their identity was. And, you know, everybody's got this point of view and identity, and everybody wants to, they see things from that point of view. And he wanted to really, really undermine and undercut the limitation of your identity. So in order to do that, it's a pretty, it can feel pretty ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
You're pretty wedded to your identity, you know, so to actually undermine that identity really is a pretty interesting process. So every time you get a project, but remember, as soon as I moved in the monastery to be still, it turns out that he like was this super Mahayana master who said, there is absolutely no use developing stillness unless that stillness is completely engaged in the world in every way. So if the stillness isn't equal on Broadway and, you know, 56th Street in New York was sitting in a mountain or in a monastery, it isn't real stillness.
Wow. And did you say you moved into the monastery at some point?
Well, I lived there off and on. I lived in the mission. I lived in there a lot. I lived in Berkeley, and there again, I've always been in a mode of living kind of all different places, sort of. So, but between Berkeley and there, I lived there. And then there was, as I spent more time there, you know, we did a refugee program, all kinds of, from the monastery while I was teaching and doing, I did a lot of, you know, different kinds of things. I was doing a lot of different things at that time. But one of the things that we were doing was from that monastery, we then, you know, went up and we got, you know, the City of 10,000 Buddhas and some other places, and then started schools, you know, elementary, high schools. The university got started there, and then we ran a refugee program for resettling refugees. And so from sitting in the monastery, I actually ended up out in the world going 350,000 miles a year flying because I commuted to New York every week and Asia all the time doing all the refugee work from the monastery. So,
wow. And you were doing – so all of this was going on while you were still teaching at Berkeley High.
Yeah, off and on. I mean, I had weeks – I remember 1 or 2 years there I was actually running the refugee program. I was actually chairman of the California refugee program, teaching at Berkeley High, running a hotel that somebody had given the teacher that was in San Francisco, and taking 4 classes on in a doctoral program.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I had these briefcases that were labeled, and I couldn't remember where I was. So finally I went to Master Wright and said, I don't have one space between one thought and another. And he said, really good. You can't have any false thinking there.
And did you take up, like, Buddhist practices, personal practices at some point, meditation and all the things that go along with
it? Oh, no. It was very, you know, over there, that's what he was doing. He was teaching, you know, really deep. It was very clear right away. I mean, in order to do this kind of freedom that he was about, there's a whole Buddhist framework for it. All these sutras are like a roadmap. They're all like guidebooks. And, you know, they're guidebooks to that, and he was a manifestation of those. So, you know, you have to do meditation, obviously, because that's all meditation is stilling the mind. It starts from a sort of observing and not being moved by the stuff arising, and then kind of being aware of awareness. And, I mean, there's a process that a person goes through, and the process of cultivating the mind ground that you would go through, that there's all kinds of roadmaps up there. So he had very intense meditation retreats for 21 hours a day. You got up at 2:30 in the morning, started meditating 3 a.m., sat for an hour, walked for 15 minutes, sat for an hour, walked for until 12 at night, you know. One break at lunch, because it was all monastic. So living with monastics in a really, really intense practice, I didn't know anything different, so I didn't know there was another Buddhism. I thought that's what it was, you know. It was really super intense, and then precepts. So then right away he said, there's no use doing any of this meditation or working with generosity and compassion and everything unless you have taken precepts, because unless you get control over these basic impulsive aspects of human, you know, if humans interact in certain kind of ways at this time, and the way they interact, there's all kinds of impulsive actions. You got to get control of those, not only in your mind, but in the body too. So, of course, taking precepts right away, since it has no alcohol, drugs, or that, already, as soon as you do just even that one precept, completely transforms your context, because before that, assuming that all that was the road to freedom, and then all of a sudden moving to give those up, you have to go through a transformation of seeing what the freedom is in the mind from where it's the freedom of impulse and those drugs and stuff are helping in the freedom of impulse, to seeing actually yourself, the mind ground, where something arising in it, and then the infinite consciousness, the infinite time and space of your consciousness, you can actually see it collapsing on the object of desire, and kind of collapsing infinity into this very limited focus. You have to actually be able to see that transformation of the mind from one kind of freedom to the other. And that takes some discipline.
Hmm. That's remarkable. So where in all this, I noticed that you're married with a wife and kids and grandkids. So where in all this, when you were doing, you know, running a refugee program, teaching, doing all this stuff, where did you find time to meet your wife? How did that happen, and living in a monastery?
Carol was a friend back in Oakland back in the old days. She was actually the younger sister of one of my best friends. And actually our family, so in fact the families actually knew each other from back, mm-hmm. you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And in fact, I think in the maybe 60s or something, we might have gone out on a couple of dates or something and hung out. Mm-hmm. And so then in the meantime, she got married. Actually, she got married to somebody I introduced her to. So anyway, in the meantime, she had gotten married, and I was still, you know, I was... And also she said you were way too reckless and dangerous to marry until you were 40. You know, you had to get at least 40 before you even had any possibility of being stable enough to not kill yourself every day. So you were way too dangerous in it to even think about in any way whatsoever. But then she was sort of in open space, and I was hung out with her a little bit. And so then she had a couple kids who were just at kind of adolescent age. And I'm like sort of an expert in adolescence. So I'm one of the few people that really love 16 and 17-year-olds and the energy of them, because I've never really gotten past 16 and 17 myself. I've always been a rebellious teenager, so even now. So I really can identify with a rebellious teenager. I still like James Dean's snarl is kind of where I am, and a little irony on top of that. So the key is that she was always totally supportive of my cultivation. Although I've been married for almost 30 years, I've only been here on the weekends. Huh. So all the week, every week, for the whole time, I was either in Berkeley or up in the city of 10,000 Bougie Kaya doing teaching in Berkeley or university stuff in Ukiah. I've been doing that the whole time. Right. So I'm only here on the weekends. I'm only down here on the weekends, and she's completely supportive of my – and that's the key. I mean, the key, if you want to do relationships and also, be on a journey, a spiritual journey, then the people relating to each other have to completely support each other's cultivation. And, if both people support each other's cultivation, there's actually some support in that. And what's marriage is just, saying – marriage is just saying, I will actually be there for you if you need me. Mm-hmm. And you can only say that to one person, because if you have two people, then you can't actually say that.
So let's back up a little bit to your time as a teacher. I mean, you've had a 40-year incredible career as a high school teacher. And you said you kind of went into it because you thought that was, it was kind of a way to start transforming people before they get kind of caught up in boxes and potentially a way of transforming culture. So what do you think of our education system after, looking at how well is education in our schools, how well are they doing at transforming people?
That's a very sad tale. And watching the 40 years, I mean, that's about a five-hour conversation, so I don't know how far to get into that. But you're right. I mean, you actually hit on the nail on the head on why I was interested in it. It was the place you could transform culture, I think, the most effective, because you have more time with people. You can actually work with people, And I love that age, because they're in the first formation of a narrative. Later on, they're usually too disappointed. 20, even by the late 20s, they're already reacting to either a narrative that works, which is then like already trapped in the views of that, or a narrative that doesn't work that already works in the disappointment of that. So I don't know. It's okay, but it's kind of late. When the narrative's first forming, it's a really good opportunity to, first of all, have a 17-year-old realize that there's perspectives beyond their own. That's the first step. And that there's profound, there's really profound thought and emotions and so forth beyond the world that they're living in their own personal experience. And then once you can get them to see that there's this really profound stuff going on outside their own experience, and realize that whatever perspective you have, whatever narrative you have, in a kind of, the first person I always teach everywhere is Nietzsche, because Nietzsche is the eternal adolescent, even the perspective you're using is just relative to context. That, the postmodern, modern world only has one difference than the traditional, and that's to realize that perspective, that you can choose perspective, and it's relative to context. And that any vantage point you're coming at stuff from that you think is true is not really true in the way you mean it to be true. It's just a vantage point. And so to get them to realize that it's not just their emotions and thoughts that's the issue, it's the entire structure of thought and view and identity that they're bringing to their experience. Mm-hmm. And then, to get them to understand that that the first thing, the first week, I, you know, work on kind of like a happiness formula, like, you know, okay, as far as, you know, as far as you go, you could either change the narrative. The narrative is the internal story you're telling about yourself that you're just making up. And then there's a certain amount of capital that you would need for different kinds of storylines. I mean, if you have a material capital, cultural capital, social capital, symbiotic capital, I mean, there's certain kinds of capital you need. So, you know, what happiness is the relationship between the narrative story and the amount of capital you're willing to go out and work for and create. That matches that narrative. So, you know, you're more free in the narrative than you are in the capital. So you have to choose, you know, which way you want to. You want to give up time to capital, or do you want to change the narrative by giving up time to working on the narrative? You know, just stuff like that in the first couple of weeks, you know.
Yeah, wow. And I understand you had an experience talking about your views of education with the senior President Bush. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I did. We were, when I was running the refugee program, it was the main place that I had some influence on the, was actually in California. I did talk to Bush, but that was more with the refugee program issue. We met with him around refugee, and I also did, yeah, actually we did talk about education a little bit. But in California, who was it? Governor Wilson. Yeah, Governor Wilson decided he was going to cut, was it Proposition 96 or something? He was going to cut the funding, which had said a certain percentage of the funding had to go to, you know, to education. And so he was Republican. And so Master Watt sent me over to eat dinner with him. So Master Watt said, okay, you just tell him that he won't get reelected if he doesn't support education. You got to get that across to him. So he sent me over to dinner with him, and there was all these, there's sort of eight people at dinner. They were all these entrepreneurs from Silicon Valley. And so I was sitting there. I didn't know how to break in because he just kept talking. It's like the way he, you know, he just, you know, people just talking. He just keep talking. So finally I knew I had to break in because Master Watt told me to take care of this. So I finally said, you know, to him, I said, really sorry to break into this. I know I'm breaking in, but why are you trying to create a why are you trying to support a revolution overthrow of the government through your education program? And everybody's food flew out of people's mouths, forks fell. He I could see his entire brain came to a screeching stop. You know, like, what did he just say? Mm-hmm. And so when I had that split second in there for, you know, a little moment in there, then I was able to, like, rush into that moment to say, you know, not supporting public education and supporting private education that's different segments of society going out and educating themselves. What keeps the point of public education is have a set of values that we have in common with each other. And as soon as you go out to do individual education from their own little, the breaking society up into all of its little component parts and have them do their own education, then you lose the platform to create common values. And so how do you know you're not creating a revolution in the alternative values and working on common a set of common values in the I've been told, I don't know whether it's true or not, but since you don't have defense, because usually, you know, that's what Republicans use defense, you know, the fear of the other, that's what Republicans do. Democrats are supposed to use, you know, like education and, you know. So I said, you know, you won't get reelected unless you change your policy. And believe it or not, the office did call, and I did talk to him more, and he changed his policy. And from that, his platform turned to that he set up a thing where the first 3 years of public school, the class size could be no more than 20, and funded that. That wow. came from that conversation.
Wow, that's amazing. So you've taught at Brooklyn High for 40 years, had this effect on people in their formative years, presumably a couple generations of people. What made you shift over to teaching at the Dharma Realm Buddhist University, DRBU?
Well, I mean, I'm really dedicated to, you know, I could talk a lot about the transformation of the public schools. I think we made some headway. I mean, I would say, from the time I started it, this move, there was a lot of, I mean, the fundamental problem in public education and education is a lack of expectations of students. Mm-hmm. For some reason, you know, starting in the 70s and 80s, educators decided they had to dumb down education or make it related to the individual in some kind of way. But there's a kind of a liberal, there's a kind of unconscious liberal racism in dumbing down education or making it fit the student, because nothing in the society in terms of work or experience or research changes. So the same, you still needed the same level of technological knowledge to make an income that you could survive off of, to make $80,000, $90,000, $140,000, which you need in the Bay Area to survive. You still need to have, so you have education working in a, society didn't change, corporate needs didn't change in terms of knowledge. The level of knowledge that people really had to have in order to function within the society actually became more technologically during that 40 years. And education tried to fit the education more and more to the adolescent mind of the people that, you know, the you know, personal experience of the individual. I mean, the first day in class, I said, I'm really sorry, you guys. I know everyone's saying they were interested in your personal experience. What would be the point of me even being here if if I wasn't trying to give you something other than your personal experience? I mean, you know. So, you know, I think it went totally, and it started with a good point that just sitting up and lecturing and just throwing stuff out is, you want to bring stuff to the individual. But the mistake was that it didn't keep high enough standards for everybody and expect everybody of all races, all groups, all genders to come to the same level and then provide support for that. And in the process of that, it had, you know, at the end of the last 5 or 6 years, the head of the African American Study, a good friend of mine, Bob McKnight, well, I'll mention right now because I really love him, he and I realized that we had to change the rhetoric of the whole thing to that racism was really not having equally high expectations, not adjusting the entire construct to meet the particular needs of a different, that a different viewpoint, although you wanted to make sure that it was in the curriculum, that a different viewpoint didn't, while it might make some people in academia really happy about appreciating the other, for a high school student actually undermines their ability to be successful.
Hmm.
And anyway, it's a big topic, but so I think we tried to bring back through, you know, a series of programs that try to bring back high levels of expectations of all students and change the rhetoric to racism as not having equal expectations of all students and bringing them to that level rather than transforming education to bring it to, you know, the other, you know, without recognizing that what you want to do is bring success within the context of the society you live in when you're talking about an adolescent. We can talk about all the other stuff later on. We can have all kind of academic conversations about postmodern stuff. But when it comes down to education, it has to be about actually transforming it so it works for those students within the constructs of the real world in which they live.
Yeah. I think someone called that the tyranny of low expectations at one point.
Yeah, well, we tried to combat that. It was a bit of a battle, but
yeah. So can you just briefly tell us about DRBU and your experience with?
Yeah. So there? Then moving on to DRBU, the big issue is bringing Buddhism to the West is a huge project. So the DRBU is an opportunity. Master Wa really saw that his main goal here was to bring Buddhism to the West. And in order to do that, you have to bring all this huge mechanism that is mostly found in Sanskrit, Pali, Chinese, and so forth, and in different cultural constructs. That needs to be brought to the West. And to bring it to the West, the universities are really, the monastic community is really important. The schools are really important. Translate, but the university is an opportunity to bring Buddhism to the West and by having it accredited, which is what we've been mainly working on lately, and we're really at the last stages of that, it gives an opportunity for us to bring the actual mechanism of Buddhism and the insights of medicine and show how even within Western thought, in many different modes of thought, the fundamental foundation of what's being talked about there is to be found, like, in all different kinds of great books and all different kind of traditions. So the university is set up to have people study different strands and from different cultural backgrounds and see the foundations of that are found there for the and lead the students to having a kind of finding their own foundation of their own wisdom and having a confidence in their own foundations of their own wisdom. The main goal that Master Well wanted to have for education was for them to find the ground of their own experience, because from a Buddhist view, human nature is really positive. It's not negative. The Western view has a sort of negative view towards human nature.
Right.
But Buddhism has a view that human nature is naturally contented, compassionate, enjoys generosity, enjoys aesthetics, and enjoys, it has a basically fundamentally positive nature that that we could share with each other in a really positive way if we related each other with positive values. And that the negative aspects that we find around us aren't in nature, in human nature. They're things that are created from society. They're created from dysfunctional ways that we communicate. And so we need to bring, so the view is that we need to bring back to students the sense of that, so then they can transform the world through embodying that.
That's amazing. How many students are at DRBU and where do they come from?
Right now we have, between the graduate, the MA program, undergraduate program, we just have just started. So in this new, we've been around for a long time, but the new accredited program that's been around for a few years, we're still just in the second year of the undergraduate program, and the graduate program's only been operating for a couple years, 2 or 3 years, too. So the graduate program's mainly zeroed in on hermeneutics, because that's the big issue. You know, hermeneutics is the structure through which we experience and perceive. And so that having a comparative hermeneutics where students can study Buddhist texts but also Western context, so they can see as they translate concepts from Buddhist sutras, the whole history of Western thought that they'd have to translate that into. So you wouldn't be able, I mean, the problem is the terminology has to be translated into a whole other language and a whole other culture, and we're still like probably in kindergarten in that process. You know, it took China a long time to bring Indian Buddhism into China. It's going to take, you know, probably, I don't know, a couple hundred years to make the mechanism of Buddhism sort of a common sense element in Western modern thought. And so, you know, the university, part of the university's thing is to try to be involved in that process and bring students through that process at the same time. And so the graduate programs particularly zeroed on that, studying Buddhist texts, Western hermeneutics and so forth, and the relationship between how you bring these texts into the modern mind. And the undergraduate is to give the students a cross-section over 4 years of different strands, Chinese, Indian, Buddhist, Western, scientific, mathematical construct. What are the grounds of these different strands of thinking to see the common deep elements of human nature in each in a positive way, and then how to not only in themselves get in touch with that, but be able to communicate with people throughout the world from different points of view, different constructs, different cultural constructs, because ultimately, you know, the goal of the student is to both develop this wisdom that's grounded in this kind of stillness, but also have that completely balanced with a sense of generosity and a sense of community based on generosity. Because ultimately, civilization is how much generosity there is. And so the balance between stillness and generosity is really important to develop in students.
Thank you, Doug. I'm just jumping in to make a public service announcement that if anyone wants to ask a question, you can hit *6 on your phone to get in the queue to ask a question. And
or email askask@servicebase.org. That's just my public service announcement, and Preeta, I'll hand it off to you to ask another question while we wait for folks to get in the queue.
Great. So I wanted to ask about your role as finance director. I mean, you're obviously such a multi-talented person and multifaceted person. You're a professor, you're a provost, you lead the academic program at the university, but you also are a finance director of the university. And I want, you know, how do you, I guess I'm just curious, you know, how you go about viewing fundraising and the material needs of keeping an institution like that alive with, you know, the freedom and the desire to be free from some of those constraints that money can place on an institution. How do you balance that and yet serve your role as finance director?
Well, it's both, you know, you're talking two questions, institutional and individual. So I'll just talk maybe more institutional. I mean, we don't really do fundraising. We talk to, basically we give people an opportunity. Because from, I think my view or our view is that, you know, money's a responsibility. I mean, I try to stay away from it as much as possible, not because I think there's anything wrong with it, but because I just don't want the responsibility of it, you know. So I want to try to keep as, you know, every dollar has the karma of the whole world running through it. So, you know, touching a dollar is an interconnected web of everything, you know. So you have to use it really carefully, and you yourself, people just don't realize the level of really subtleness of the whole thing of money and the karma of it. So people that have it, that are responsible, have to use it for something purposeful and useful, or else they've completely wasted their time getting it. There's no purpose in it at all. I mean, getting money has no purpose unless there's some reason you want to use it for compassion, good, and generosity. Otherwise, people just get uptight, irritated, want to hold on to it, you know, start wars and stuff. So, I mean, they're just, you know, I think we provide an opportunity for people who have resources that if they could see what we're trying to do and the good we're trying to bring about, that it gives them an opportunity to use their money in a very, we don't ask people for money. We give them an opportunity to use their money in a useful way. Nobody gets paid any differently in the hierarchy gets all paid exactly the same. Nobody gets paid more. And everyone gets paid just on the basis of survival basis, because if you made more than that, then there'd be some other purpose involved in it. And if there's another purpose involved, then the problem is in the karma of you being involved in the institution is already a problem. So you have to have everything running just right. The amount people are getting paid, if they're not getting paid, then they can't do it. If they're getting paid too much, then they're there for reasons other than just doing it. And then they're losing the blessings of doing it. So there's a perfect place. There's a theoretically perfect place where money can be used perfectly in every context, within the causes and conditions that it's being used in. And if you can get the closest to that place, it'll take care of itself.
Wow. So when you say you want to make, you provide an opportunity, you don't fundraise, but you provide an opportunity for people to, of resources to use their accumulated karma in the form of money in a certain way, in a useful way. How do you identify those people? Are those people already in, you know,
we're not very good at that either. We're not anybody watching us try to function, wonder how do these people ever function up. We're not organized in any way to do very much in that regard. We don't go out and do anything that anybody else does. We just talking to people and somebody's interested and you say, well, we're really bad because we don't even ask anybody exactly. We just if somebody sees the possibility, they see, you know, we'll probably have to get better at it, I guess. I guess we have to organize, we have to maybe get out there a little bit more so people can even understand what we're trying to do and then have the opportunity it's just through, you know, conversations with people and people that have affinities or come across it in some kind of way or... Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody's, I mean, I think we do need to do a better job at getting out there so people have the opportunity. But we don't ask people for, you know, I mean, Master Hua never asked anybody for anything because there's no need, you know, you don't ask anybody for anything. If people want, if they want to do something with their responsibly with what they've got, then that's great. If they don't, then they're just going to be all tied up in the bitterness of their own, like, greed, you know. So it's just an opportunity for people to not be greedy, that's all.
And on that note, we actually got a question. Someone anonymously submitted a question through the live stream, and they said, from planet Earth is where they're submitting the question from. They said, you mentioned something like, generosity is the mark of a civilization. Clearly, Buddha spoke about dana, which is perhaps more charity than generosity, and bodhisattvas cultivate this ground of compassionate offerings. But from a modern context, can you speak a bit more about the nuances of generosity and how it relates to culture?
Well, sure. I mean, generosity, generosity is a basic nature of humanity that feels really, really good when you do it. And it's also like a major marker of cultivation. Like, you can develop all the stillness you want and all the wisdom that you want, but until that wisdom is actually integrated with the causes and conditions of the whole world that we live in, it's just a kind of solipsist, narcissistic self-reflection. So from the Mahayana, I mean, that has to engage the whole world. And the first move of engaging the world is this incredible sense of wanting to give, the generosity of giving, which feels super good. And when people are able to develop that generosity, it opens up their heart. That then is the other component of the stillness. The stillness and the generosity are one and the same. They're like, they just go together. And then you measure a person by their generosity. I mean, that's an external, eventually you need markers. Somebody's stillness, you can't really measure. Their generosity, you can. Generosity of time, generosity of whatever. And, of course, civilization is just civilization is giving individuals the opportunity for freedom, and then those people who have gained something from that freedom, sharing that with others, that's the mark of civilization. If you don't have the two of those, there's no civilization. There's barbaric, you know, there's just a barbaric, non-civilized existence. So those have to be brought together. The stillness is the ground of where the awareness can observe and gain wisdom. The generosity is the heart in its natural conditions, you know, sharing whatever, from sharing spirit, sharing aesthetic, sharing money, sharing whatever aspect of sharing.
Right, yeah. I'm curious, you also, I mean, you had the opportunity to spend time with this, with Master Hua, this incredible Mahayana Buddhist master, and you first mentioned, you know, you were kind of drawn into it by going to this freedom war with him when you first met him.
Yeah.
Can you describe a little more about what you mean by this freedom war? What happened?
Well, he was, you know, I mean, I thought I was pretty free because I could do anything I wanted. I had no superego, could go anywhere in the world and do anything I wanted. So I thought that was freedom. And he said, well, yeah, there is a kind of freedom in that. The problem is that every time that freedom comes down on something, you have no idea how to make a choice. You can't see, you have no wisdom to see in the infinity of choice and no, man, you have no way to know, you have no way to see or have wisdom within that to see the causation of an action. So then you just get bound up. Any action you're going to take is going to get bound up in something. So you have to, like, develop much more discipline of mind to open up that awareness of awareness that gets past where the compulsion comes up from the unconscious. If you, as soon as you're done sitting or whatever, then you're just more free. And if you don't have constraints, the greater freedom you get, the more possibility is for getting all involved in stuff that you're confused in. So you have to go really far in that awareness of awareness. And then at some point, you can gain a kind of a real freedom, which is a freedom from the desire, from seeing that the only problem is that you're only looking at stuff from that freedom, people and things, from the limitations of your own narrative and your own desire. If you could get rid of your own narrative and your own desire of that, then that freedom could be realized and experienced and explored, and the aesthetics of it could be explored and experienced in a really open and free way, and not have it be limited by the limitations of your own view and desires.
And did you have a dialogue with Master Hua about this? How did you come to see from this view? It sounds like, you know, before when you were on the hippie side of the freedom war, the conversation with freedom you chose was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But then your teacher was talking about this other kind of freedom that you're describing.
Yeah. I really liked that freedom. I didn't have any problems with it. It wasn't that I was like unhappy with it or something, or looking for something or something. It was just like experiencing him in his manifestation of that. I could see that in a lot of ways he was a lot more free than I was over time by just watching him. You know, I traveled with him in Malaysia. I was around him a lot. And just watching that form of nomadism and that form of freedom, I could see something about there was really a freedom of mind. And then not only was there freedom of mind, then it was re-engaged. That freedom of mind was actually re-engaged in the total dynamic causal constructs of the universe at the same time. So it wasn't like a stillness or emptiness that was removed. It was a stillness or emptiness that was completely engaged. So how do you get, stillness and emptiness completely engaged at the same time and everything that's going on? That's pretty, pretty deep.
And
watching the manifestation of that, the actual manifestation of that was pretty kind of remarkable.
Right, yeah. I remember you sharing before about how when you, all of you would work at the monastery, whenever you got comfortable in a certain position, you would end up, Master Hua would end up switching things up and send you on to head up some refugee program or to do something else.
Right. He never let you get, you were supposed to do whatever you did really, really well. And if you didn't do it really well and really pay attention to it, then you got, really criticized. And then if you got attached to doing it in any way, then it got taken away and you did something else. So you had to do something really well, but you had to do it not with attachment to it, because if you got attached, then that was knocked out because then that means you started limiting your frame of reference again by the attachment.
Yeah. Were there, speaking of just kind of that, those lessons, were there any particular moments or lessons with your teacher that really stand out to you?
Let's see. I mean, there was just so many different inner, it was more of a general sense of stuff. But I mean,
or any experience. There's a memorable story of when you tried to go mountaineering and he told you not.
I fell off an Annapurna. Yeah, I can tell that really quick thing there. But I was traveling with him in Malaysia and we were giving all these speeches. I mean, for one thing, it was like completely crazy because we were giving these talks to 1,000 people, and I looked like some kind of aborigine that they had picked up in Borneo or something like that. I had this beard that went straight out, hair that went straight out. I looked like I really did look like an aborigine. And he had us up on the front there, like giving talks to Chinese and in Malaysia. They were going, where did you pick up this aborigine guy? And he had us, actually giving talks. He never said a word about it. I don't even know, now looking back on it, it's totally nuts. But I decided that while I was like, I decided I had to go climb the Himalayas. And he said, no, you don't know what you're doing. Don't go climb the Himalayas right now. Maybe sometime, but right now, no, I got to go climb the Himalayas. And he says, no, I don't think it's a really good idea right now. You don't see the cause and conditions real well. And so I was up in Malaysia. In those days, I was kind of traveling around the world all the time, and, you know, India, blah, 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 Sri Lanka and stuff. So I just I was going to climb. And he says, no. And so I remember this exchange. He said, I said, well, I'm going to go up because I'm in northern. It's cheaper for me to go from here. He said, okay, I will give you any amount of money you want. Any amount of money you want, I'll give you right now, and then you don't need to go, right? I said, no, I still want to go. I said, okay, I'm going to go because the weather's better right now. It's going to get worse later. He said, okay, I'll take care of the weather. The weather will be perfect when you get there. If you wait a little while, I said, I guess I really want to. So he says, you have no idea then what you're doing. You're just going to go anywhere. And so I headed off. I went through Burma. I went through Thailand, Burma, blah, 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 Nepal and stuff. And then I was climbing up on Annapurna, and I fell off head first and landed 40 feet down on my head and then had to be helicoptered out of there. It's a whole big story I won't get into. But
oh, my gosh.
So,
wow.
He's,
how did you fall? Like, what happened?
Oh, I just was out there. It was a crystal clear night. I was up on about 17, 18,000 feet on Annapurna. And this other guy, well, I just met this guy in Burma, and he'd been living in Asia for about 3 years, and we didn't have any equipment or any Sherpas or anything. I mean, we just had our shoes. We had our tennis shoes, our Levi's, and he didn't have a sleeping bag. We got him a sleeping bag and a coat, and we just headed across the Himalayas with no guides or anything. We didn't even know where. We just had to ask people, where's Annapurna? But I was completely reckless, you know. So we just started climbing Annapurna. We had no anything. We didn't have anything. We didn't have any equipment. We ended up in some village up there at about 12,000 feet where we got some cheese and stuff and put them in our backpack and then just started climbing. So I don't even, you know, what to say. So I got up there. We were in this little cave. It was like, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night. So I was looking up in the stars up there. It was really bright stars up there. And then people were coming past us to go climb up in the high, you know, they were going up there. It was the year that the women who went up from Berkeley to climb Annapurna, and two or three of them fell off and died or something like that. It was that summer. What was that, 78 or something? And
so then you fell. And
so I was looking up there, and actually, literally, I don't know, because it was literally like, I don't really know. I was standing there, and then it fell. All of a sudden, I just fell off, and I don't even know. I remember at the time, I don't know why. It almost like something like almost like pushed me or something like that. And then I just landed, and then, of course, since I landed on my head, I crushed my skull and all this kind of stuff. And so this other guy had to drag me, got these hunters down a little bit further, and they dragged me up there, and then I just lay there for a week because there was nobody to, you know, there was no, in those days, there wasn't the same kind of communication. So I laid there for a bunch of days until somebody sent somebody to get the helicopter from the Royal Nepalese Army from the U.S. Embassy or something like that. So anyway, that's a big long story. That's okay.
And yeah, that's an interesting story. And what did Master Hua say when you came back?
When Master Hua came back, he says, so I ended up, somebody called me and said, where are you? And I said, are you still alive? And I said, yeah, I guess so, because I'm talking on the phone. They said, well, come back up here, because Master Hua. So I go back up to the city, and I'm sitting there, and Master Hua said, oh, we'll lay back. He goes to kill himself. I said, no, I didn't. Come up here. He says, How many times did I tell you not to go? I said, oh, maybe three or four. He says, you guys, you Western guys, you're so headstrong. He says, I told you don't go up there. You go up there anyway. He says, you go kill yourself. He said, you actually killed yourself, you know? Do you remember you actually died? He says, you actually died, and the Buddhism bodhisattvas had to go and save you. He says, I sure hope you don't make a bigger mess out of this life as you did the last one.
That's great. Thank you, Doug. I think we have about 9 minutes left, and we have a question that came in through the web form from Brenda in the Bay Area. She asked, can you share more about relationships that are rooted in spirituality? What qualities are most important in cultivating those relationships?
Actually, if you cultivate, you actually might be able to relate. And probably if you don't cultivate, I'm not sure if you can. So because it's all the traits, it's like a little bit of stillness of mind, you might actually listen to somebody else in their own experience of themselves rather than an interpretation of them through your needs, desires, wants, and views. So you don't actually relate unless you cultivate, as far as I can see. And then if you actually have a little bit of stillness and a little bit of awareness, and then you can actually listen to somebody else, not from your own vantage point, then you're experiencing them within their own experience. Then if you care, or I guess, you know, love them, then you just accord with their conditions. Because what is the point? I mean, so what is there that you – so if you're cultivating, you should be then confident enough in your own stillness that the other person isn't about neediness. The other person's about sharing existence and not trying to solve problems that can't be solved about human existence. And so then you support – the goal of the relationship is to support each other in cultivating the independence, the freedom, the confidence in the other person. And they're doing that with you. So as a really good relationship needs each other less and less and less, and then relates out of supporting each other's greater and greater independence and greater confidence in their own spiritual foundation. And finds great joy in the independence and freedom of the other person. And then when you come back together, you're sharing completely new existence every day, rather than in the mechanism of a pattern of control, or you did this, I did it, you know, trying, you know, endlessly doing whatever people are doing, which I have no idea what they're doing.
So related to that, Doug, I read this really interesting thing you wrote about when you were in some of your writings about freedom. You talked about like the acquisitiveness of the Western notion of freedom, about how getting more and more and more people think they're becoming freer because of that, from that power base. But you said this interesting thing about how no matter how big someone's bubble, like no matter how much they have, we're always living up against the edges or boundaries of our bubble. So no matter how much you have, you're always still living at that point of the feeling of, you know, scarcity or so to speak. And that the only way to, when you're always bumping up against someone's bubble, that the only way to be free is to give up will altogether.
Yeah, that's actually Schopenhauer. You know, that if you put Schopenhauer and Deleuze and probably what, and then you know, and then Habitus, you know, the stuff on Habitus, if you put on Nietzsche all together, you can see that then we're into the question of power and freedom. So the in terms of analyzing, each of us analyzing ourselves, what ultimately do we want? I mean, from a Western view, we ultimately actually want to do whatever we want to do. And so if you look at, if that's the goal, we want to do whatever we want to do, which I'm not sure, I mean, that's not as deep as what I think people could be, but that's kind of where we are. If you actually look at it from that view, then the way we have the most amount of power is not having to do what somebody else wants us to do, or getting somebody else to do what we want them to do. The problem with getting somebody else to do what we want them to do is you have to have power over them, and they have to agree to do that in some kind of way. They have to get... to not have to do with somebody else, you actually have to have a lot of power to do that too. You have to have a certain amount of capital to be free to do whatever it is you actually want to do. So the problem is that, you know, no matter how you come at power and freedom from that vantage point, you could, you know, have the greatest amount of power that you want, but the power itself is always at a boundary of somebody else. A boundary at somebody else's either power over you or your power over them in order to get them to do what you want to do or not have to do what somebody else wants you to do. The whole of capitalism is just using the money symbol as the boundary membrane of that, right? money's just a membrane boundary of that dynamic. And it's ultimately about how we each use our time, the freedom of our time, because all we have is time, and then the question is how we have to use our time. And so you just have to come up with a strategy. I mean, from that point of view, you come up with some sort of strategy. No matter how, the more power you have that needs other people for the empowerment, then the more that you're touching other boundaries of that power. And so, but on the other hand, being free from other people, you can't just be free from other people's power without power either. They're just different strategies. Americans are mostly, it's real interesting, Americans are mostly interested in being left alone by other people. They're not interested that, and so they read everything through being left alone, and whether you're right-wing or left-wing America, it's all about freedom within a certain kind of construct. It's just that the two parties have totally different groups of people and different constructs of what they mean by freedom of what. But if you see the boundaries of that, so if the Buddhist ideal of it is that if you look at it from not having to do what somebody else wants you to, so you have the freedom of your own empowerment, then the further you can be not in need or want or desire, the more freedom you have. Because the less of a boundary that you have to create in terms of capital and exchange in order to create that. So as you simplify down to as close to nothing as you can get, you less and less have to be involved in the relative aspects of capital and boundary and stuff.
Wow.
Doug, going deep. Well, we are at 10:28 a.m. here in Pacific time, so we have about 2 minutes left in the call, and I wanted to close with one final question of how can our ecosystem be of service to you, Doug? Is there any ways that we can support your incredible work?
Sure. I mean, the main thing, it's not me. I mean, I don't need to be supported. But I think the university, I think the students in the university and the university community, I think we have a huge amount and our retreats and our retreat center up at Sudna that's got 60, 80 rooms and we, do retreats in and stuff. I think there's a lot of ways that we could be interconnected to serve each other. So, I just hope that we can communicate with each other a lot and work together in a lot of ways. And I can see us, like I can right away, if you gave me an hour, I could give you, like 100 ways that we could interrelate that would serve each other.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your Saturday morning to be on this call and to, share all your nuggets from, thoughts on financial systems to education to being on, in the Himalayas and everything in between and being, in Berkeley in the 60s and your upbringing. There's so many gems from your life that really can shine light on a lot for all of us. Preeta, I don't know if you have anything to add before we
close. Yeah, no, just so grateful to have this opportunity to be in conversation with you, Doug, and I look forward to more opportunities to learn from you. You have so much to offer, and I'll be at your retreat.
Okay, well, that's another, we do have some, they get full pretty quick, but there's other things too. I mean, as I said, let's talk about ways. I think it's the key these days is that we help each other, we work with each other. And I know we have huge amounts of interrelationship that we can work together and support each other. So let's just figure out all those different ways we can do that.
That sounds great. And Mish in New York writes in, thank you, Doug, for sharing yourself with us today. Your vibe
okay.
is so full of
good luck to everybody.
I have been smiling throughout this call, smiling in Brooklyn. So we'll just close with a minute of silence and gratitude, and then afterwards I will unmute everyone and we can do our creative, chaotic thank you at the end. So just a minute of silence. Thank you all. Thank you. And I will unmute everyone so we can just say a quick thank you to all. On the count of three, one, two, three. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.